welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy Sun, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. You know, every week I start out by saying I'm excited because of the guests that I have on the show. I'm going to say it again today. I'm excited. Excited to have a friend, I would say advisor, a counselor, a fellow board member, and a whole lot more. But today's interview is going to be a lot of fun, because I have a very dynamic individual with me, a lady who knows everything about marketing, branding, coaching, you name it for executives. She has done it and does it well. And quite frankly, just watching her in action is a blessing for me. So it's going to be a good hour just today, and we're going to have some fun. So ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, I welcome to the podcast this week none other than Linda Lockman Brooks. Linda, how are you?
I am well, Gerald. It's so great to see you, to be with you, and to have a chance to have a conversation.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm actually looking forward to this conversation because we'll learn a lot about you, stuff I never knew before. And quite frankly, also get for you an opportunity for the audience to hear why I'm so excited you're on the show today and the inspiration that you bring, not only to individuals, but every space that you're in. You don't know this, but I watch from a distance, and people who have impact and have gravitas, I always look and try to learn from them. So with that, we're gonna jump right in. Who is Linda Lockman Brooks? What grounds her or her early years, and what undergirds who we see today?
You know, it's so interesting when someone asks an open-ended question like you ask your guest. And you always seem to hit the nail on the head and get your guests to open up and be authentic about who they are and where they came from, and most importantly, where they're going. So if I had to start at the beginning, I am the daughter of Otis Lockman and Jenny Lockman, born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. Raised, educated, and started my professional life there. I'm also a wife and a mother. My husband is Will Brooks. Our children are Morgan Brooks Thompson, and our son is Garrett Brooks. And I have a wonderful son-in-law named Ross Thompson. And when I think about how I got started in the world, I owe so much gratitude to my parents, because they were, and I don't even think they realized it, they really raised my sister and I to be all we could be, whatever that meant. I always felt this sense of comfort and protection, and yet an expectation, because my dad's favorite phrase was, to whom much is given, much is required. And he would often say, as did my mother, you know, you have it a lot easier than a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. So don't take that for granted. But he used to also say, you know, you have to do 200% just to stay even, little girl. Don't ever forget that. So I think that my parents did a great job of grounding my sister and I, helping us feel protected and nurtured, and yet instilling in us, really, and I always say through osmosis, a sense of responsibility, a sense of caring about others. And I feel it just got embodied in us. And so I'm very, very grateful for that. Mm-hmm.
So mom and dad is a great influence on your life. What was the household like in general? What was life in the Brooks household?
And the Lockman household.
The Lockman household, I'm sorry.
Right. And I laugh about the fact that when I hyphenated my name so many years ago when Will and I got married, I did it really in homage to my dad, Otis Lockman, because technically I was the last of the line. My dad had siblings, but none had really had sons. So the Lockman name was kind of, quote unquote, ending with me. I also married someone with a short last name. I'm a marketer, and I felt like Lockman Brooks worked. So, and I liked my name. I liked Linda Lockman. I liked that alliteration. Yeah. But our household was interesting for the time in the, you know, 60s and 70s growing up, because my dad was a rarity of the time. He worked for Anheuser-Busch. He started with them as a sales rep in the 50s. And initially, when he started with Anheuser-Busch, Mr. Busch was really a visionary because he hired several quote unquote colored reps to call on the black accounts, the grocery stores, the taverns, the liquor stores that carried Budweiser products. And he was smart enough to know that if he had people that looked like them as their sales reps, he started that. And that happened in the early 50s, not only for Anheuser-Busch, but I believe for several other brands. So Daddy started in that role. And by the time my sister and I came along, he was well established. He was doing well. And when they integrated his territory and he started calling on all kinds of customers throughout a multi-state territory, we grew up in a house where Daddy traveled every week. He had a company car. He played golf. It's so interesting. You know, we have so many friends. My husband is an avid golfer, but my dad belonged to a golf club. Now, again, don't get it twisted. There were no country clubs in our family.
Right.
Daddy and his buddies played at the public parks in St. Louis. Forest Park is still a beautiful public park there near Washington University. They played there, and there were lots of public courses there in the St. Louis area. And there was a club, an organization of black guys that played and played in tournaments all over the Midwest. So I had that kind of exposure early on. And yet I always loved the fact that it was a great balance of this is great and we have this, we live this good life. And yet my father always kept it real. You know, he always somehow embodied that spirit of, yeah, but you know, this could change. And you got to hit your numbers. You have to meet your objectives. You have to exceed your goals. So that was very embedded in our upbringing. My mother, who had worked outside the home before we were born, my parents were a little older when they married each other and had kids. So we had the privilege of my mother being at home with us. But we used to joke about the fact that when she went back to work when I was in high school, she said she really should have continued to work. So that was a conversation between the two of them, though. So we were very fortunate in that. As I look back on that, you know, having a mom at home when you got home from school, being there for you, and it worked well because Daddy did travel. But his travel and the exposure of, we moved, we had a corporate move when I was in third grade. We moved from St. Louis to Kansas City. And then we were there 3 years, and then the division office moved again and they moved us back to St. Louis. So I had that experience as well as a child. And it was rare at that time. And families didn't move around like they do today. You guys have moved so much with your kids and you go for the next opportunity. But I actually had that experience at a young age. So I look back on that and I feel really, privileged. And I also I appreciate that exposure and those experiences. Again, but like a lot of black families of the time, you know, again, my parents kept it real. And, you know, in the 70s, when you know everybody was growing their hair out into an afro, my father was sort of like, now, wait a minute. I worked really hard to give you a good life. And yeah, I understand black power, but power is an education and getting a good job. Mm-hmm. So it was that balancing act. So I felt like, yes, I've been protected on one hand, but on the other hand, you know, my dad was sort of like, you know, you gotta hit your marks and get it done.
Mm-hmm. So is it safe to say then there was a good measure of discipline in the Lockman household about how you did things?
Correct. I think that's a fair statement. Discipline, encouragement, an expectation. Mm-hmm. I remember wanting to do well because I wanted my parents to be proud of me. And I really felt this sense of appreciation. And some of that may have been once I realized, my mother was so funny. I'd ask her how old she was. And she'd say, you make me younger than I am. And I realized that, yeah, she had kids a little later for the time. And it did keep her young. So I think there was that kind of unspoken responsibility of, look, you got to take care of yourself and make them proud. So yes, the whole idea of discipline. And yet we had a lot of fun. My parents were very social. Daddy belonged to this club in St. Louis. If there are any St. Louis people out there listening called the Royal Vagabonds.
Wow.
It was a men's club, probably similar to, but just St. Louis based, similar to the North, like the North Carolina Guardsmen or maybe even the Boule, but it wasn't a fraternity. It was a social club, and they bought their own building back in the, I don't know, early 60s. And that they had their own building. It was a gathering place for the guys. It was also a great party site for Tina. You could rent it. And so, again, my parents were social. The Vags gave the best New Year's Eve party every year. And I couldn't wait to be a grown-up and get to go to that party.
Yep.
So responsibility, expectations, but fun, social. My dad was the one that my friends used to love for daddy to be the one to pick us up from parties before we were driving, because my father would come in and he'd start a conversation with the other parents. And they knew that we'd have 20 more minutes before we had to leave the party. His daddy knew everybody. And again, he was a social animal. Again, he called on all the great, you know, places to go get a good drink in St. Louis. Yeah. And again, there was a sense of liveliness and having a good time and yet getting it done.
Well, you know, something's interesting. I'm looking at the gleam in your eyes. You're speaking about your dad. And I look at your career and what you've done over all these years. And I'm seeing a connection with your dad and what he did. And you said this, you got to hit your numbers, make your marks. That's a marketer speaking right there. So I would say, is it fair to say it was birthed at that time? And then as you're going through school, say middle school, high school, did that passion stay with you? Did you know you want to do that all the way through your growing up years? Or did you go a little bit one way, another, feel your way out?
Good question. Actually, I couldn't have articulated it back then. Mm-hmm. And yet I grew up, and I said that our kids have grown up the same way. I grew up understanding brands. I grew up understanding market leadership. Because again, daddy being in sales, we had all the paraphernalia. I remember when they launched the beer Michelob, and he had a promotional piece that had a bottle cut in half and the ingredients were shown. It was really a cool piece. And he brought that stuff home. You know, the signage for Michelob, Budweiser, Busch Bavarian was another brand. I don't even know if that's still around. So that idea of brands and leadership brands and really having a quality product, that kind of is in my DNA, but I couldn't have articulated it then because I actually ended up majoring in education.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my degree is in education, you know, little known fact.
Yeah.
And it helped me in my corporate career because I kind of parlayed into HR early on and did a little bit in training because I had this education background. But the marketing piece was in me. I think, again, I just had not articulated it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I got, and fortunately for me, Gerald, I ended up graduating high school early, but didn't go away to college. I wanted to go to Howard desperately.
Yay, Mecca.
Yes, I would have been a bison. But I ended up staying in St. Louis and going to the University of Missouri there. The deal with my parents is 2 years there and then go off. Well, I ended up getting a job. Mm. And my first job was with, well, really was my second job, but I worked in a department store. But my job was with TWA. I was a ticket agent all through school. And I learned the world of work while pursuing my education. Mm-hmm. And through that, and I ended up going into the management training program at TWA and getting into a marketing role and going, oh, I'm home. This is me. I understand this.
Wow, wow.
And so I never looked back to teach school, although I used to tease my husband years later when we were living in New York. I said, you know, I'm certified for life to teach school in Missouri, so don't bother me. Fortunately, so far, so good. I haven't had to utilize that.
You've not had to pull that trigger.
Correct.
So I would never have known that your degree is in education. So I have to ask this question, like, right up front here. Your presence in terms of your knowledge of brands, coaching of individuals, and melding the two together to drive an image or a product. Is that a combination between what a little bit of daddy, a little bit of your formal education coming to life? Is because I'm fascinated by the fact that I would have thought you did marketing in college, or I would have never thought education.
I definitely took some communications courses. Mm-hmm. I did. But I was pursuing, you know, again, it was the 70s, you know, and even by that time, while there were people that looked like us going into business and marketing, what have you, you know, again, I didn't really, even though I had been exposed to it, was what my dad did. Remember, you, and I had seen it, but even I didn't translate that into being it directly. And yet here I sit. Yeah. Having now had, you know, 30 plus years in the marketing and sales space. So it is a combination. And it's a combination of not only my father, but my mother. While she was at home, my mother was also a consummate volunteer. She helped found a nursery school foundation. She was involved in the YWCA, and she was involved in League of Women Voters. Mm. So I had that example of volunteer, being engaged in your community, reading the newspaper every day. My mother had that cup of coffee and the newspaper open when we went off to school.
Yeah.
So once again, children, you know, it's through osmosis. It wasn't said, but it was done. So when I think about the person that I've become, it really is that combination of the exposure, seeing what daddy did, seeing what mommy did, and their encouragement. My mother was always, when I have the chance with TWA to moving out of that first entry-level marketing role and take a huge promotion and move to corporate headquarters in New York. Interestingly enough, my father was proud and encouraging, but he was like, yeah, but sweetie, you don't have to take that. You're 21 years old. You don't have, you can take the next promotion. My mother was like, go, take it, do this. Now, what's the worst that could happen? If you hate it, you stay a year and you come home. Once again, I feel so fortunate that I had always had that safety net.
Yeah.
We talk so much in today's world about the safety net, what COVID has shown us, how when people don't have a safety net, how you know, things can just turn so poorly and folks can get behind financially. We weren't wealthy, but we were solid. And my parents, my mother felt comfortable enough to say to me, hey kiddo, if that doesn't work out for you, you can always come home.
Yeah.
So no, that was a confidence that I had.
And I want to stay right there for a minute and ask your opinion on something or your thoughts. When I'm listening to your journey and how you made these moves and connected the dots, today our young people, we pretty much still tell them that you have to get on this path and this is the path and you go step A, B, C, D, E. So I'm going to ask you to put your educator's hat on. When you see our young people today in our dispensation in time today, do you pause and say, that might not be the right way? Or do you find ways to plug in? What would you say to young people today that are so laser-like focused on, I got to get to point A, B, C, D, E? What would your advice be?
Well, I actually think they're teaching us, Gerald. I think that, and I look at my own children, they've been fortunate, they've been blessed, they got a good education, we help them with that. Our son, who had started with a business career after, he's a Morehouse man, after getting a graduate degree, and then working in business. He's now a creative. He writes, he has a writing partner. He works for a website. He determined that that creative side was really where he wanted to be. The thing that I love about today's young people is that some of us in my generation say, well, you know, they're not hitting the marks. I think that they are really focused on, many of them, being happy and being fulfilled. Mm-hmm. We never thought about that. I never worried about being happy. I was lucky that happiness came, but I was worried about getting that degree, getting that good job, making my parents proud, hitting the marks. So what I say to young people, and I talk to lots of young people for a variety of circumstances, clients, young people that are working in the marketing space who I connect with, I really encourage them to navigate it. Because again, there are very few paths anymore. Mm-hmm. When being in consumer marketing, I used to say to folks, in fact, a friend of ours' daughter just got her MBA and she's going to work for Procter & Gamble. That used to be, to me, the ticket. Go work at P&G. They have a process. You move from this position to that position and you learn consumer marketing. That's still a good path. And I teased this young woman because I said, finally, somebody did what I've been telling folks to do. My own children didn't go work at P&G. Mm-hmm. That's fine and that's great. But yet everybody doesn't have to go work at P&G. There are also, Gerald, not the layers of organization that there were when I was coming along. When you came into a company, you were a manager, then you were a director or a senior director, then a vice president. Organizations, if you're talking about larger companies, are flatter today. Mm. We have a lot of individual contributors. So I think that young people should explore the things that they enjoy, that they excel in. They should definitely be prepared and get credentialed. I'm a trustee of Central Piedmont Community College. I love the work of Central Piedmont. Mm-hmm. And I've really learned about what community colleges do. Everybody doesn't need a four-year degree, no offense. We also have our programs like Niner Next. You come into Central Piedmont, and you're automatically admitted to UNC Charlotte. The Royal Up, automatically admitted to Queens. And now we have a partnership with your former folks at Johnson C. Smith.
Wow, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yes, wow. Yes, that's very, very new. So again, but it's flexible. There are some individuals of all ages that can go to a community college and get credentialed in something that if you want to be a truck driver and get credentialed at the college, you can do that and make very good money. There's some tech fields that are, we have a partnership with, you remember, Red Ventures. Yep. We have a partnership with them. So again, there's so many more paths. So I'm really okay with the young people who are saying, I may try this, I may try that. I think it's okay. Yeah. Now, sometimes I argue with my peers about that.
I wish I was a fly on the wall to hear that argument, because you are a healthy debater. So that should be a good discussion. But Transworld, you went to New York. Is it New York?
Yes, New York City.
I met you in Charlotte. So how did you get from New York to Charlotte? Because I know you were at Nations Bank and turned to Bank of America. And I think you were at Duke Energy at one point.
Correct.
How did New York translate to Charlotte? Because now you're such a presence in the Charlotte area. How did that happen?
Well, I love Charlotte. But as I joke, and there's a, you know, as you can tell, I have a sense of humor. I tease my husband about the fact that he kind of tricked me. I thought we were coming to Charlotte for two or three years. Our children were very small. They were born up there. I was actually in my dream job at that point, leading a marketing division for American Express. Prior to that time and the move to Charlotte, I'd worked for TWA. I moved through several different kinds of roles. I was a sales manager. I called on commercial accounts. I really grew my experience set there at TWA, but I recognized early on the industry I was in, the sector was changing. Deregulation was coming. My best friend, who I met, she moved up there from Ohio. She was a Kent State grad, and she was an MBA from the consortium, if you remember that.
Yes, I do.
She worked at Bristol-Myers, and she encouraged me. She kept saying, you know, you'd be great as an account supervisor at an agency. So what did I do? I did what now I know, what I call connecting, some people call networking. I began to reach out to the Black people that I knew who were at agencies and talk to them about their paths. I was still in my 20s, had made some good friends and went to people that were, you know, 5, 10, 8 years older than I. There's a wonderful woman who has passed away, Carolyn Jones. She wrote the line, we do chicken right, or Kentucky Fried back in the day.
Really?
She and another man named Frank Mingo had a Black ad agency. They opened doors for me and introduced me to people. And I ended up getting an opportunity at J. Walter Thompson. So it was almost like getting my MBA at work. I went to work for Thompson. I took a salary cut.
Wow.
And worked on Lever brands, Unilever brands. And so I really got the consumer marketing experience at the ad agency. Worked on Burger King, worked on a lot of fun accounts. And from there, again, being in New York, back in the good old days when headhunters called you every week about different jobs, a headhunter called me about an opportunity with American Express. And I left Thompson and I went to Amex and then built my career there. And really, when I think about it, I loved all the companies I worked for. My years at Amex were fantastic. Great company, marketing-driven company. Ken Chenault, who's now retired as CEO, he was on his trajectory. You could see he was headed. Yeah, he was. And one of the women that worked with me was really good friends with him, so I got to know him a bit. It was a small cadre of us, of young Black executives there. Great years, great years. Yeah. And fortunately for me, when my husband took the role that moved our family to Charlotte, had a good reputation. I had great relationships. The president of my division looked at me and he said, well, you know, you can go to Charlotte and be our vice president of sales. Wow. I didn't even know that that happened for people, you know, and I was flabbergasted, but again, had enough je ne sais quoi that I said, well, thank you, Ron. That's fantastic. Meanwhile, I thought I was in there ready to say, please, sir, I'm going to get this done before I leave and I have to quit my great job. So again, very fortunate along the way. However, daddy's, you know, my father by that time had passed away, but his voice is in my ear. Hit your numbers, get your, you know, do the things that you need to do. Make sure you're building authentic relationships. And it was because I had great relationships when the president of the division called up the guy in the Southeast and he said, hey, you know, Linda Lottman Brooks, her family's moving to Charlotte. She could do that VP of sales job down there, right? And there you have it.
Wow.
The really?
The power of connections, right?
Connections and relationships. And, you know, that guy who said, absolutely, that's a guy who years before when he'd call up to corporate and ask for somebody to come down and introduce the advertising or come to the sales meeting or go on sales calls. Sometimes I could send my staff members, but I used to go because I liked staying with the customer. I loved being out in the field. And if I hadn't done that, that guy wouldn't have known me as well.
Wow.
So again, the lesson is, you know, expand your reach, do it for the right reasons. I had no idea that I ended up working for this particular gentleman at one point. So that's how we got to Charlotte. Will's job was the catalyst. I was able to stay with Amex. And then once we got to Charlotte and Will then said, you know, eventually, Lockman, I want to have my own business and the kids are doing well and we'll probably stay here. And I was kind of like, what you talking about, Willis? I'm going back to New York. I'm going to be CEO of American Express. But again, no regrets. It was a great move. And that's when, again, I had been approached by the bank. And at that time, NCMB was becoming Nations Bank. They really were trying to get national level marketers, national experience, you know, because they've been so regionally and state focused. Mm-hmm. So it was a perfect opportunity as I joined the company. I joined them as a senior vice president, which was literally hadn't happened for Black folks or a woman.
Right.
I didn't even realize that at the time, but that was sort of the way, you know, those were the parameters. And I was the regional marketing executive and worked on all the merger communication. So it was a very exciting time to be at the bank at that time. And I'm really proud of what they've become as Bank of America.
Yeah.
I was at the bank 5 years and then I went to Duke Power as they were becoming Duke Energy. So again, the thread here is merger, transition, building a brand, communications, that line between staff and corporate. Those were my expertises, if you will.
Wow.
And that was the value I think that I brought.
Well, this is fascinating. I did not know any of this. And I've known you now for a good little bit. And this is fascinating. So you're in Charlotte.
Yes.
And when I met you, 13 years ago or so. The first time I met you, just your presence, you and your husband at church.
Yes.
Is when I first met you guys. And I've always watched you. I've watched you from a distance. We serve on the park property management board together. And I listen very keenly when you speak. The gravitas, if you will, that you have there in Charlotte. I'm just going to speak solely about Charlotte. How did you develop that? How did you build that? I see you and another, Sonia Nichols, for example. You guys have this, you have the it about bringing people together and getting them to move. And that has solidified your stature, I believe, in Charlotte. How did that happen? How did you
do that? Yeah, I appreciate that. And I appreciate that question. I think, again, intentions matter. So when we got to this town, I had very young children. And yet I entered Charlotte through the business community. Mm-hmm. First as the client relationship manager, VP of sales for American Express, calling on the primary then regional banks. So I got to know the community through the business community lens. And yet I'm a parent, I have young kids, I joined Jack and Jill, you know, I did the things that families do to assimilate and, you know, shore up their environment. Fortunately for me, American Express was always encouraging of its leaders to be engaged in the community. And I had an opportunity to join the board of the YWCA early on. And in that experience, I met not only business people, but civic leaders, women like Sally Robinson.
Oh, yes.
Women like Mary Lou Babb. Yes. Women like Joan Zimmerman. You're yes. nodding. These are women who yes. are now, you know, in their late 80s, but they adopted me as a 30-something who was willing. I was interested. I was curious about the history of the city. I would talk to Mary Lou about how in the 70s, the schools desegregated. And she drove carpool because they kept their kids in public school, whereas a lot of families moved them to private schools in the South.
Right.
So I was open to, I like to believe that I was open to listen, to understand, and to get a sense of appreciation about the community in which we were living. Mm-hmm. And over time, I built those relationships and they've been sustained. And I had a fortunate opportunity to not only be this business person. So again, I'm comfortable in those rooms, but I'm also comfortable in the rooms that where these civic leaders, like a Joan Zimmerman, who have incredible gravitas. And who've helped build this community. So, and I got to know those women and I was very interested in their stories. Mm. One of the things, again, both my parents and in particular, my father, I'm a talker. I can have a conversation with a rock, my husband says. Yet I'm also a listener. Uh-huh. And I think that the thing that got me on the path of having, if of any gravitas in this community, is the fact that I listened to people and I listened to their stories and got a sense of who they were and who they are. Mm-hmm. And then I was able to tell them my story. Mm. So you have to be interested in that. And I know, you know, Charlotte, sometimes people complain about, oh, Charlotte, it's all the uptown people. And, right. oh, you know, I was very involved in the arts for a number of years. And, you know, sometimes, you know, people want to, you know, throw a little shade and say, oh, the arts, why are you involved in the arts? And I'm like, you know, have you ever heard of jazz? So, I was one of those people when I came to town 30 years ago, I was interested. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to learn about this community where we were raising our family. Mm-hmm. So I believe that probably contributed to it. And then I think that I'm consistent. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. something that I often tell when I'm throwing a little shade at people sometimes, you know, when you're the Black person in the room and at the table, you have to show up mm-hmm. and you have to be consistent about showing up mm-hmm. and you shouldn't just put your name on the list.
Wow.
You need to add value and recognize you're speaking for people who have no voice sometimes.
Wow.
I can't speak for every Black person in Charlotte, but I certainly have a perspective and I could certainly provide a point of view and be in a position that if someone who doesn't look like me wants to know more, maybe I can open that door. And for whatever reason, Gerald, I just took that seriously. It wasn't something I set out to do. I just think that I show up, I'm consistent, and I always tell the, well, I always tell the truth. And yet I try to do it with some grace.
Right.
And I think that that, you know, and yet I didn't grow up in the South. I didn't have some of the scars of some of the situations that some of my friends faced, and people even older than me faced. Yet I still grew up Black all day long. St. Louis wasn't perfect. I knew that there were parts of town we knew we should not go. And again, my father's 200% rule, he said it a lot, and he especially said it to me when I was probably 18 or 19 years old and going for that promotion. He said, nobody's going to pay you because you're cute. You're Black.
Wow.
200%.
Wow.
Just to stay even.
Just to stay even.
So it kind of comes back to that.
It comes back to that. So now you are, you mentioned the word grace, and you and I met through our pastor, our bishop, the Park Church, and the work that Bishop Alexander has done in that city and what he is known for and all that he has done. As you look at the intersection between the work you do in the community and the work you do for, say, park property management, is there a common thread with your faith? And does your faith come into play in all that you do there in the city?
I believe that it does. Now, you know, I was raised Lutheran. And I became a Baptist. Thank you, Will Brooks. I became a Baptist because that's what my husband was. And my dad always said, you know, sweetie, you know, if you can go to church as a family, it's a great thing to do. You know, no offense if families aren't able to do that. So Will and I had the same value system, but I was raised in an interracial Lutheran church in St. Louis. Or lots of different kinds of people. And so faith, my father was a trustee for our church. You know, I make jokes about having gone through confirmation classes and, you know, I had to take courses.
Yes.
Before I was confirmed.
Uh-huh.
So my faith, yes, it's important. I don't feel like I wear it on my sleeve per se. And I think that's fine if some people do, if they lead with that. It's embodied and embedded in me. So I know that it sustains me. And it has sustained me during hard times. A lot of what I've said to you tonight, it's all positive, but I've had my down moments like everybody. I've been disappointed. I've there've been jobs I didn't get. There've been results that I was not happy with. And my faith sustained me through that. My faith has also sustained me through the high points and the blessings. You know, as you may remember, you know, we have a daughter that has had a health crisis and she has survived and thrived through that. Faith has definitely kept us through. Claude used to say to me, Linda, you woke up this morning and she woke up this morning. Start with thank you. So I'm very focused on that.
That sounds like Bishop Alexander.
yes. he really has walked that journey with us.
Yeah, he'll just give you the reality and you got to figure out the rest.
But that's right.
That's why we love him and care for him so.
And I'm really proud of what he has really done. Again, that consistency of Claude being in rooms that some African-American pastors wouldn't go in. He has been a voice. He's been someone who participates. He speaks his truth. And yet he is also willing to listen. He models that. And I'm very proud to not only call him my pastor and bishop, but my friend.
Same here.
And he and I had that in common before we were even members at the park.
Oh wow, I didn't know that, but
yeah,
he is a blessing to my wife and three children and my whole family. So, you know, he's a special person in our respective journeys. I want to pivot a little bit and come to modern day, what we are seeing. The park property management is trying to. We started out trying to do something, and we can see the ebbs and flows of what's happening on that side of town. But I recently saw that you were part of a social justice discussion. When you look at your upbringing, you being up north, you coming down south, your corporate life, your community life, and time just marching on, as you look at where we are today, what comes to mind for you? What tugs at your heartstring in your various roles and what you would like to see for not only Charlotte, but the South or the nation in general?
Well, I think we are at a very pivotal point. All of the pain and injustice of last summer's events with the killings of African Americans by police. And it was a flashpoint that seemed to come together after George Floyd's murder. And of course, you know, the recent verdict for that disgraced police officer, Breonna Taylor, and others, Ahmaud Arbery, you know, all of those names that we have to say. I feel that it is important to talk about these things. I feel that we're at a point where people other than Black people are now really paying attention. Before, they had the excuse of, well, I didn't know. Well, now they know. The whole concept of social justice, I think, again, is at a very pivotal point. And we've got to get policy that will sustain change. That's my Linda's personal opinion. I think that when I pivot to the business side of things, and you know, again, being a marketer, I was very intrigued by a lot of the beautiful commercials that came out last year, and pledges by CEOs, and lots of conversation about what organizations are trying to do. I feel that there will be some good done. It's important, however, to remember that we've got to keep the sustainability piece. So I feel encouraged by that. A lot of the DEI work, diversity, equity, and inclusion, is important. We're calling it different names. It's similar to things that were happening when I was a young professional with affirmative action, yet different. I think that the focus is not just on Black people, but all kinds of people who have difference. And organizations are saying, they're talking about it. So I think that's good. The thing that we have to watch against is that we're not just talking about it and that we're doing things and we have policies, both business policies and political policies that help us sustain this shift. And while I always approach, I am not a DEI practitioner per se, I've been involved in some project work, but always from the standpoint of communications.
Right.
How are we translating the message? How are we talking about this? How are we being authentic? My friend Joan Zimmerman loves to kid me. She says, Linda's favorite words are intentional and authentic. And they are.
That you are.
And you know, you're my church member, so I can't say one of the words I say that is not, that is very colorful. It has an initial B and an S with it. But there's a lot of that too. So being authentic and being intentional will help us sustain the change that we're beginning to see. I think that young people can be somewhat cynical because they can look around and say, man, you all, you know, when the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965 and we still aren't there and there's still moves to change access for voting. And it sometimes feels very overwhelming. And yet we still had great outcomes in some markets. So we have to stay the course. I'm preaching a little bit, but that's how I look at it. But I am encouraged when I see organizations who are making commitments. And I have seen organizations, you know, you look around and so, for example, Lowe's Home Improvement here in Charlotte has a Black CEO and his C-suite is so diverse and it's no big deal.
Right.
Got all this excellence sitting around the table. And so their employees are seeing that. And again, when I did the interview with the communications agency here and they said, what are you proudest of? And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to talk about a project because a lot of the work that I do is behind the scenes. I work on strategy. I may be behind the scenes on a marketing initiative that, you know, might happen in a year, but you have no idea I had anything to do with it. And that's okay. Right. I do executive development and executive coaching. I don't talk about the people that I've coached around the country. That's mm-hmm. confidential. Right. So again, I'm able to, that's why I always point to my civic work, because I can talk about the things that I do as a volunteer. And I said in that article that you mentioned, or that conversation, I am most proud of the times that I've spoken up. Because if I don't speak up, someone who has had privilege, someone who's had access, someone who has had exposure, and someone who does have a level of confidence, and I can walk into a room. Not to say I've never felt unsure or I've never felt intimidated. Of course I have. But for the most part, I walk into a room and I try to see it for what it is. Do I add value? Is my voice being heard? And if I have something to add, if I am telling the truth or I'm adding value and adding some expertise and I look like me.
Yeah.
And the people across the table or around the room don't look like me. If they're hearing me, maybe the next time somebody that looks like me is speaking to them, they'll expect that and not be surprised. Mm. The other thing, Gerald, that I did this year after the things of last summer, I decided to join the board of visitors at Johnson C. Smith.
Wow. Okay.
That was something Linda could do as a volunteer to help add my voice to the other advocates for the university.
Yes.
Because our HBCUs, as you know, are so important.
Yes.
And adding my voice to the voices of many other civic people for Smith and helping tell their story, that was something I could do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When people have said to me, what can you do? It's so overwhelming. It is overwhelming. And I've had lots of days in the last 12 months, not just due to COVID, but because of the social unrest, where I was sad and I did feel hopeless. Mm-hmm. But then again, you talked about faith. Faith teaches you that you just have to believe in things that you cannot see.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I tell people, figure out the things, something you can impact. And then, you know, for my really wealthy friends, I say, write a doggone check.
That will help some. That will help with the messaging and get a consistency that you speak about. Exactly. I had an opportunity to interview Otis Moss Jr. Mm. And I had asked him if all the work that they did in the 60s and that tremendous work they did, he thought that we would have been further along. And he, in his very candor, he said, you know, in certain things, yes, he thought we would have been much further along. So as we got about 9 minutes left, and I'm going to ask you a question that I've asked some of my guests. This podcast is really about getting people to see folks who have gone through this process, but more importantly, to have the guests give them words of inspiration and encouragement. You've done so throughout this discussion already today, but if I was to singularly focus and say to you, in this COVID environment, people are, the economy is shifting, modalities, even in colleges and universities of teachings have shifted, people are nervous, anxious. What words of hope and inspiration could you share? Because this audience is typically young professional, believe it or not, and young people who are trying to figure it out. What words of hope and inspiration would you give them?
That's a great question. First of all, I do believe, I'm going to go again with my strong suit on the business side. I think that we've had a fundamental shift and we're going to have a hybrid environment where we will continue to do things like you and I are doing for this conversation. We'll continue to use virtual platforms in a big way as a way to do business and connect. So young people, I think, are comfortable with it. They've grown up with apps and everything on their smartphone. So I think I would say to young people, this is great. So you have this skill, this ability, this platform, that's going to continue. And yet when you have the opportunity to engage individually or in person, cherish that. And really, really hone in on those moments. Of course, every young person I would encourage to get vaccinated.
Yeah.
Make sure that you're protecting yourself and the people around you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can sometimes be a bit of a Pollyanna. I'm a positive person and I'm hopeful. I am hopeful because I do, while there's so much to make us sad in this environment of kind of being in lockdown has made us a little tentative, because I've been very COVID cautious for sure. I am hopeful for the future. I think we will travel again. I think I know things will open up, but we have to do it in a safe way. So it really is about making sure you have what you need, making sure, you know, you are focused on how you can be your best self. And the other thing I would say is that sometimes it isn't about you. Sometimes it's important for you to stop and say, okay, what can I do for somebody else? I really believe that's important. And we can kind of get caught up in our own, you know, circumstances and our own poor me situation or our own positive things. You know, I'm doing so great, you know.
Right.
Sometimes it's good to stop and think, okay, well, what can I do for somebody else? So those are the kinds of things that I would say, that I'm saying to the young people in your audience. Stay hopeful, stay current, read, know what's going on. You know, I did fuss at some of my friends. They were watching way too much cable news last year.
Yeah,
it is important to be informed.
Yes.
But that's not only being informed about the political landscape, that's being informed about your communities. And that gets back to the point about doing something for someone else. As you know, here in Charlotte, we definitely have been really, really struggling with the whole affordable housing situation. There's some things coming down the pike that I think can make an impact, but we've got to stay the course.
I was in Charlotte recently, and you know, when I was at Johnson C. Smith, they were talking about the light rail.
Yes.
And how it seems like it's just a reality. And Malcolm Graham, I ran into him in Georgia and we were talking about it. And he's been on the show as well. Charlotte is changing. And one of the things that, having lived in Washington, D.C., when Abe Pollin moved the stadium from Landover to downtown and what happened around it, I see the same things happening. And do you think people that look like us will no longer have the whole gentrification and all that? Is that a concern of yours there in Charlotte?
It is a concern. I think that there are those who look like us, though, who are making sure that along the Bates Ford Road corridor, that the regentrification doesn't really run everybody out.
Yeah.
I do know of some African-American investors who bought property, commercial property, and they're trying to develop it. A lot of that property is owned by people outside of the state, I'm told.
Oh, wow.
They don't care. And so they let a lot of the stuff that goes on, and then they'll sell to the highest bidder, and then it'll get gentrified. So again, I choose to remain positive that we're going to keep our eye on the prize and that we're going to watch that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw the wonderful article that our former mayor and transportation secretary, Anthony Fox, wrote about the urban removal when Brooklyn was decimated. Right. It's a wonderful, I think he wrote it for CNN. It's a great
read. I will have to check it out. I saw a tweet from him about someone paying a visit the other day, but I didn't really follow it all the way through.
Yeah, because when he was growing up, that's when Brooklyn was changed and they did the highway through.
Yeah, I didn't know he was that young. I was surprised when I saw his age. I was like, wow, he has accomplished quite a bit.
So much. I have the distinction of when he first ran for city council, I went to a little doodah for him and he was running at large and he was great. And I met him once, and then I raised my hand and he said, yes. And I said, hi, I'm Linda Lockman Brooks. What would you have me tell my neighbors? Would you have me tell them that you're running at large and anybody in the community, in the precinct can vote for you? Doesn't have to be district. Would you have me tell them that? And he always teases me and says, thank you. You know, at large, everybody can vote for the at-large member, not a district. And he I don't think he covered that. And that was always so confusing. And it was a party for people that were all transplants.
And I think from then on, that I just can imagine from then on, he knew who Linda Lockman Brooks was. Well,
and he does.
that is just who you are. And I am so humbled that you joined me today on my little podcast here. That I know what's funny about this podcast. When I was just starting out, it was Michael Dean Perry from Charlotte, my very first guest. Oh. And Bishop Alexander said, yes, he was my third guest. And from Bishop's appearance and in Dorothy Yancey, Johnson C. Smith, again, this has just been a blessing to so many people. And I hope my audience today gets a true sense of another life and journey in you and got some pointers. I know I got some pointers and tips as to connecting the power of relationships and making your voice be known. And this was believe it or not, we are at an hour. I told you it would run very quickly.
It did go fast.
It did go fast. But I'll give you the last word. Anything which you would like to share that I didn't ask a question, or something on your heart that you would want to share with the listeners?
Well, I just love to say how proud I am of you. We are so pleased that you spent time with us in Charlotte. You stay connected to your Charlotte family, not just your church family, but your university family. And we're very proud of you. I really appreciate the platform, the concept of a podcast. Again, as a communicator, just rings true to me. So this is authentic. And I'm just delighted that you thought to ask me, and I was thrilled that we were able to get it on the calendar and get it done. And
absolutely.
And I wish you continued good luck in everything that you do.
Thank you so much. And, you know, we'll touch base from time to time from our board work, but it has been a pleasure and an honor getting to know you guys and the Charlotte family, obviously our bishop, and he brings us all together. But to know you personally and the work that you've done in Charlotte and that you're doing, I am just so grateful and humbled that you took some time to spend with me, just spend an hour and with my guests. I can tell you, I do get calls from mothers about their daughters, because the podcast is entitled It's Easy, Son. It's based on the book, but the perspective, lives well lived, and the experiences really inspire our young people to say, look, things are tough right now, but here are folks that made it through. And if they did, I can do as well. And I just thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your story, which I know is going to be a very good episode when it airs later this week.
Thank you, Gerald. My pleasure. Continued blessings to you and Sharon and the quote unquote kids. I know they're all grown up now.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Well, audience, there you have it. My good friend, Linda Lockman Brooks, just shared some powerful truths today. And I hope that something was said, a message was heard, that will inspire you to see your life circumstances through a different lens. A lens that will take you far above where you thought and exceed all your expectations. So until next week, remember, this is It's Easy, Son. Your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. And until next week, be safe and be good, as we know that all good things will always come to pass. Take care.